This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Today, our guest is Sunil Freeman. He's a name everybody knows, and you will know him now, too. Here's Sunil.
The Nile Stream begins with me walking fast, a winding path through deep woods, wondering what's next. Music, first muffled in the dark, draws close. Keyboards, guitar, bass, drums, electric, a sound that's spiraled down decades, almost to DNA. Miles. The band, all faceted thrash and fury, cymbals flared to guitar riffs rising, calms into a groove that grows to find its way home, which is to say, the blues. Enter the horn. Hmm. Wake up, Buddy Bolden. Wake up, Muddy Waters. Satchmo. He blew a cathedral that night, unseen in the pine forest dark. Then, solo done, he's there. We stare at each other. The band burns on, invisible, back among the trees. No words, just a glance. Me and Miles, in a sudden cocoon of silence in the woods. I look him in the eyes. 2 long seconds till the band picks up a new sound, high and sweet, tentative, a bird learning to fly. I'm on soprano sax. Miles gives a few short notes to point a path, and there I go, not quite Wayne Shorter. They should teach his Spanish key solo in calligraphy schools. But still, I'm playing. Miles scowls as if to say, "You're no Wayne Shorter." But he smiles just a bit as I ease into the solo, then he heads on out.
That is Sunil Freeman and me and Miles. And yes. Sunil and Grace are together again. Wake up, Buddy Bolden. Sunil's here. He's the author of 2 books of poems. That Would Explain the Violinist, which is Gut Punch Press, and Surreal Freedom Blues, Argon Hotel Press. And he does many more things, which we will divulge as we go on. You've been writing for more than 20 years?
Oh, sure. Going back to the early 80s, and, of course, some really bad rhyme poetry in high school, too.
What is the hardest thing that you've confronted writing poetry?
Sometimes I go into writer's block, and I think about writing rather than writing, which I think happens with some people. And sometimes life just gets too busy. At a time, I try to keep a journal, and I'm moderately successful with that. Mainly write poetry, sometimes essays too. So
mostly we will find music wherever Sunil is. Mostly we will find music in the line. In fact, you actually put us onto a nice sale on Mozart pianic sonatas.
Thank
Remember
you.
That?
Sure.
So
yeah.
He's the man.
Yeah.
And you'll hear the music. And you'll read it in the line. So let's have another poem.
Sure.
Sunil Freeman.
Thanks.
I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
Accordion. Chords and oompa fade to a lone note that quivers and holds, then rises. The sound like smoke that lifts and curls its blue-gray line to the air. There is a cafe, and I am drifting in the France of my mind. Let the photos come alive. The lens zooms slowly into the frame. So still life becomes cinema. We're in color now, the accordion jaunty once more, rolling like the distant hills, like birdsong trills that silver this summer afternoon. There's a vineyard in the foreground, drenched in sun, and here at hand our laughter, a burble of Chardonnay as we empty the last of the bottle. Perhaps nearby they are debating Godard's old fights with Truffaut. And yes, somewhere in the village, Grappelli spins arabesques while Django strums and waits. CD? LP? Who knows? We are but children grown older, languid as grapes, tethered to the day till the lens pulls back, chords drop off, and rhythm narrows to a foot trail, which winds back to the cafe, the accordion, a whisper, a sigh, and gone.
That's Sunil Freeman. I forgot to say, you'll always hear a little whine in there also. I hear your poetry, and I know you as a person, and I know you as a worker, as a literary citizen. But when I read your poetry, I know more about you. I've discovered something. What have you learned about yourself as you write the poem? And you finish and you thought, wow, that's something I didn't know about myself.
Sort of the ability to be surprised by things that you'll hit as you're in the writing process, certainly. A lot of music comes through in the poetry, and I've been playing a little bit more with forms from time to time than I used to. So those are some of the things, autobiographical things from way back. Also that something that happened and struck a chord many, many, many years ago will come out and decide to be a poem. The Miles Dream actually was about 15 years before I started to think of even writing the poem.
And speaking of autobiography, he is the assistant director of the Writer Center, and that's in Bethesda, Maryland, but we call it the Washington Writer Center.
Sure.
Because it really helps with everyone in the environs. And he's been a managing editor of Poet Lore, the nation's oldest continuously publishing poetry journal. Now, everyone attributes that to Poetry Magazine. And I know that
right.
Poet Lore was in the 1800s.
Right. We were founded in 1889. Walt Whitman actually took out an ad in He took out an ad in Poet Lore announcing the final edition of Leaves of Grass. Poetry Magazine had a stretch where they weren't publishing, so the continuously publishing is crucial, as you said, Grace.
His poems have been in various journals of significance, Gargoyle Bog, Abbey Minimus, Word Rights, and the Delaware Poetry Review, Beltway, right. The WPFW Anthology,
right.
That time-honored edition, Cabin Fever and Kiss the Sky, Fiction and Poetry, starring Jimi Hendrix, another poem by Sunil Freeman.
Thank you. This one was in Gargoyle, and I wrote it after reading a news account of a soldier's mother who had learned to keep his clothes unwashed. Wash. They wash the scent away. His clothes come clean. No blood or sweat, just fading memories. Her baby's hair she kissed on summer days. The creek bank mud that stained his old blue jeans. The blood from Little League. The hard slide home that won a game so long ago. The cheers, and how he didn't cry, his leg scraped raw. There was a child went forth, Walt Whitman said. Mm. He could have been that boy 10 years ago. His senses all embraced the world, but now a man. And Whitman knew his war up close. Before they washed the scent away, he told it hard with grief, but not as mean as those who'd fly the bodies back at night unseen.
There is such tenderness in that poem. Can you, in addition to the content,
mm-hmm.
which is defenseless, can you point out for the audience any words that you think make up the tenderness? I mean, that's since the poem is made of words.
To me, I think it was sort of thinking of the child in his youth, the baby's hair, the memories that a mother would have of a child, the creek bank mud, all the playfulness of childhood. I grew up in the golden days when kids hung out on their own, alone, and bumped into friends in the park and walked through the woods alone or with friends, and we're not quite as scheduled as I think children are nowadays. We lived close to Sligo Creek Park.
You think that was a good thing?
I think it was a great thing. I'm glad. My parents, I think, picked the house partly because it was close to the school and close to Sligo Creek Park. Let me put it in a
word. So you were born in Washington?
Born in Raleigh, North Carolina. Moved to Washington in 1961.
And how old were you?
I was in second grade, which makes me
eight,
6 years old.
Like
six
oh.
years old, yeah.
Oh, because you were smart.
I was a month smart.
Sunil Freeman, I've never known. I asked you for a biography, and you gave me like three sentences. And I thought, oh, Sunil sprang right from heaven because I know him, and that would be him. But what is your lineage?
My father was from North Carolina. And my mother is from India. They met in a refugee camp. My father's father was a liberal Southern Baptist preacher, which is sort of unusual in North Carolina. And my father, early on, mainly I think on issues of racial justice, found himself attracted to the Quakers and was involved with racial civil rights sorts of issues in his teens and late 20s. And he went to India with the American Friends Service Committee, where my mom was a volunteer in a refugee camp working with young children. And
what is her first name?
Flora Freeman.
Oh. So yeah. That's the Sunil part of you.
Yeah, sure. That's the Sunil Kumar part of me.
Sunil Kumar?
Kumar.
Okay. We're here together. It's Grace and Sunil together again. We see each other about every 15 years for 1 minute.
And we email back and forth.
But it's always a passionate minute.
It is.
And this is going to be too. Here's another poem. Are these new?
Fairly new. Within the last couple of years, say.
They're not in the books.
No. There are two I'll read from the books, but everything else is
What is the title of this?
This poem?
This bunch.
Assorted Miscellaneous Poems. I don't have a title yet.
We'll have one before the hour is done.
Beautiful.
Sunil and Grace.
Returning decades later to Dr. Bronner's peppermint Castile soap. It hits the cupped water and fills and bubbles to almost running over, and the bored and sullen morning air wakes with a start as it remembers, this is what I do best, and goes happy so fast it hallelujahs a gospel of peppermint to the room, which sings it for all the world, all one, all one. And once again it is, as always, the first day of the rest of my life. Cleanliness is godliness. Peppermint air pulls me fast back to 1973. A food co-op, herb shop, basswood honey, carob macaroons, soy flour, morning thunder, and recipes for a small planet. The air is sweet with unironic patchouli, a joy we'll never again have. Hot tuna is on the turntable. Yorma plucks forth bittersweet happiness in some minor key. Jack lays down the ground for this long-gone day to drift on.
Unadorned?
Unironic.
Unironic?
I like the smell of patchouli.
Good. Yeah, that is the 70s evoked all over again. You said that you had sometimes a hard time starting a poem because you're so busy. I mean, I know you at the Writers' Center. You have a phone on each ear, and I'm not kidding. But what do you have to stop or say goodbye to in yourself to write a poem? What do you have to say goodbye to because you're going to do this?
That's a hard one. Sometimes you just have to set the time aside and find, you know, something, just sort of start digging for little things from the day that have been around. I tend to take a long time between the triggering town sort of moment that wants to become a poem and then actually starting to get it going. Poems take years for me to write, it seems like sometimes, fairly often, and they'll sit for a while and then they'll find their way into print. I like to walk, too, but I can't walk as much as I used to, and that's the arthritis, some things related to that. But that gets me going, too, just walking, wandering.
You've seen how many poets, just take a guess, come through the Writers' Center in your tenure? How many have you heard read?
Probably several hundred. Several hundred. Typically, we have readings once a week, usually two readers. And sometimes if there's an anthology or a magazine reading, which is something we like to do too, because it you know, really just helps the community getting the word out on some really good writing out there. So I would say several hundred.
What do you think that we all have in common? I mean, you've heard all, I sort of ask you this because over 31 years, I've heard, I think I have a history of American poetry.
Oh, sure you do.
In the 20th century. And I think I'm able to see strands. Mm-hmm. And what do you see that we all have in common from all you've heard?
A lot of times, some kind of autobiographical family history being mined and worked through and in the poetry. That's something I see fairly often. And certain thematic things that people, different poets will obsess on something and just, you know, keep going back to it in a good way.
Obsession. What a new idea for a writer. Sunil Freeman is here. He's assistant director. He's secretly the director of the Writers' Center. You have a new director.
Yeah, let me put in a really, really good word, a bunch of really good words for Charlie Jensen, who's our director. I've been talking him up, and he's a really great addition to the place.
Sunil Freeman is here, and he's going to read us another poem.
Okay, this one needs a little bit of setup. After Hurricane Katrina, a couple years after, actually, I wanted to write a poem, and suddenly it came to me that the John F. Kennedy iconic statement, "Ask not what your country can do for you," if that collided with what happened in Katrina, it would make an interesting poem as that worked its way through. There's one reference, when homes were razed, that's razed, torn down, R-A-Z-E-D, and not razed, built up. And I put John F. Kennedy in a historical perspective that might offend some people, but here we go anyway. It starts with, "Ask not what your country can do for you," from the John F. Kennedy inaugural address. "Ask not. Forget he won with Daley's machine, stole an election in Illinois, no deep old touchscreens there, then invaded Cuba. Forget Vietnam, our puppet Diem set up to die, a corrupt pawn. Forget he first opposed the March on Washington. Check it out, but let it go, and drift dreamily back to words like a song of times gone by. Ask not. The air was crisp, the newsreel shows, in black and white that day, and Robert Frost read a poem. Play the line back now to New Orleans, as levees broke and men with guns and SUVs ruled the streets. Blackwater. Ask not, blocked on the bridge, forced to retreat. The killer cops aimed for real. Ask not from the rooftops. Ask not for the children or bodies bloating in the flood. Ask not the representative. We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. Ask not when homes were razed, money flowed to part of town. Saints were called to march back in, and glasses raised to commerce, horns and drums and jambalaya. Your country pledges you no allegiance. Don't ask."
Sunil, if you look at that poem on the page and you say to yourself, I mean, every poem has something organic in it, right?
Sure, sure.
And something contrived,
right,
to make it a poem.
Right.
Unravel that for us. What's organic in that poem, and what is the contrivance that makes it, holds it into a form of art?
I think the repetitiveness of the "ask not" becomes a sort of an indictment of what happened. And the language just started to play with itself. When I first thought of the triggering sort of concept, it seemed more like a video piece, but I don't know video art at all, using the Kennedy line over and over again, because that clearly was a circumstance, and it's not unique, where the country wasn't there for the citizens at all, and that was what sort of needed to be said.
So the structure was a construct, but mm-hmm. the imagery...
Right.
That is more heartfelt, isn't it?
Sure.
I mean, didn't that come
from
the senses?
It did. It did.
The jambalaya, too.
Right, right. With all the New Orleans.
Well, let's go on and see if we can discover these things all by our very own selves.
Great.
This is Sunil Freeman. We're at the Library of Congress, and he is the author of two books of poems and one which needs naming bad. And we will give you a lot of money, the first one who calls in with a great name after you listen to him. And get the sense of it.
It needs more poems, too.
They send poems?
Certainly. This one is, the title is "Walking Sligo Creek Park, 1970, for Ornette Coleman. Across the street and through a field, the path curves up to woods that summers past became free jazz, a sound that wailed and wobbled, still transformed somehow to grace. With Dolphy's horn, a bird call honk, and distant trumpet chirps. A green so deep it might be undersea, and stillness even in a breeze, the soft undersides of leaves, ferns, skunk cabbage, a stink like earth's own blues. A bird would sing, and then another, while basses lumbered pizzicato and thumped against the sacks, whose keening lines called back the floating pulse, and drums just danced around the beat or tapped a golden wash above to crown it all.
Let's keep on.
Okay, great.
While you're getting the other one, did you ever send that to A.B. Spellman?
No, I didn't. That was in Delaware Poetry Review as well, an online journal, a great online journal.
It is good. You know, A.B. wrote the book on Ornette Coleman, I'm sure.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
that. And, you know, he would really love to hear that. I'll give you his email.
Okay, oh, good, by all means. He's actually going to be reading at the Writers' Center
later
on.
He's going to be on the program,
yeah.
too. Well,
beautiful.
Yeah,
beautiful.
His new book is out.
Yeah.
Things
yeah.
I Must Have Known.
Yeah. It'll like be that. A very good, good reading. We're looking forward to it.
Here's Sunil.
What the man in the frayed sweater might be thinking. Metrobus, February, 20 degrees. His eyes shift like he's tracking reflections. So I look at the motion picture mirrored in the glass. Translucent buses and cars run down ghost pedestrians who keep on walking, a cartoon world. He stares out the window as an armada of cumulus clouds races across the sky. Riffles of cirrus might be ripples on a wind-tossed sea. Lampposts, grayish-white, suggest sycamores. The window reflects rectangular chunks of sky, like some old avant-garde photograph. The man's in his late 30s. Watching him is like seeing pictures of European Jews before Kristallnacht. Mm. He's alive for now. The way he turns his head, I'm pretty sure he's noticed the whine by the left back wheel sounds like a Middle Eastern translation of the blues. Miles could have polished it into something unforgettable. When his eyes close, I think of waiting for buses, how the cold hammers a man to a place where warmth, when it arrives barreling down the road, triggers a drone which begins in bone marrow and spreads till his temples are those of a child. And when that buzz synchronizes with the hum of the bus, he closes his eyes, alive and not hurting, and that's enough.
Sunil, that's beautiful. Would you read just the end of that again from How Cold Hammers?
Sure.
That's gorgeous. I loved that, and I was trying to write it down really fast.
Okay. When his eyes close, I think of waiting for buses, how the cold hammers a man to a place where warmth, when it arrives barreling down the road, triggers a drone which begins in bone marrow and spreads till his temples are those of a child. And when that buzz synchronizes with the hum of the bus, he closes his eyes, alive and not hurting, and that's enough.
Drone, bone, marrow, buzz, hum, bus. You got it going on. Did you know that when you were writing it?
It sort of just fell together. It was I use public transportation a lot, and I've been the guy waiting in the cold sometimes for the bus, too.
And you even had some wine in that poem.
Oh,
Or the one before.
Did I? The one before, I think.
You always got a little music or a little wine.
Something.
I know that music influences you. Are
sure.
you somewhat of a jazz scholar?
I wouldn't say a scholar. My father loved the music of Charles Ives, an avant-garde American classical composer. And so my sisters and I, it was a great way to grow up. It was a really great way to grow up because it was daddy's crazy music. And then gradually it expanded us. We grew to love that music.
And a precursor to jazz. I mean, the
sure.
notes are standing
sure.
on edge,
yeah.
aren't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, very much so. And so.
But if you know Ornette Coleman, then, I mean, that's like the top 1% of jazz lovers.
Sure.
Know Ornette Coleman.
And late John Coltrane, too, the later stuff. And the earlier stuff, too.
What other art forms influence you, do you think, besides music?
Poetry, obviously. In the last 10 or more years, I've been reading a lot of more creative nonfiction and liking what I read there. People can work music in an essay too, certainly. They can.
Right. I read it. I read your essay.
Okay.
Several of your essays on that have music
sure.
in them. What is the one that I called you about? Where was it published?
There was one in Word Writes about the arthritis that made reference to music.
There have been several that you've written.
Mm-hmm.
That's really a métier for you, mm-hmm. to combine your poetry experience, your daily experience, and your music knowledge.
Right.
It all comes out in some good stuff. Sunil Freeman is here, and he's going to read us another poem.
Talking. Not quite poems, but more like the rind of poems. How your wine glass, raised right, coaxes a plump ruby from falling afternoon light. How we know the river scene, sun-dazed shock of blue and white to silver, could use a sailboat. What the boaters might say. I love it when you say, marinara, say anything at all, like, try some of this. A waft of butter and garlic roams from your bowl to mine, mine to yours. As our words find a rhythm, we might walk. We look from the canvas back to each other, touch glasses, let the silence breathe a while, then head on down that road.
That's put out by Argon,
right.
Hotel Press, and I think it's still available.
It is, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
That is actually one of my favorite poems in that book.
Oh, thank you. Others have liked that one.
Yeah, that
too.
Mood, okay. The tone of that poem is so good. And we wouldn't mind another one yet.
Okay. I'll read one more poem, and I'll do one quick preface. There's reference to gypsy eyes, and we didn't know at the time that the Roma people don't like the term gypsy. It's considered a slur, a slander. But when Jimi Hendrix wrote the song, it was about his mother, and it was not intended as a slur. So apologies in advance. The title is Nightbird, and it's based on a true incident. Nightbird. High on a river bluff, cricket scratch shimmer, sweet clover, a drowse. The hillside breathes, slow motion ripple, to ride gently, gently. A mockingbird shreds the spell. If graffiti could sing. Still as a statue, I still breathe. So he's query, curse, all song, till I whistle a warbled fragment, gypsy eyes. Well, I realize that I've been hypnotized. Silence, freighted with Lord knows what firings in his bird brain. And then Jimmy rises, brilliant, loud, in the night sky. The mockingbird sings.
Sunil Freeman is Assistant Director of the Writer Center of the Greater Metropolitan Area of Washington, however it is, happens to be housed in Bethesda, Maryland. And we'd love a final poem.
Okay, this is the Silly Einstein poem. I call it Drafts for an Imaginary Cartoon. Einstein's in a bar, and there's this gorgeous physics groupie next to him. She's thrilled. Einstein. Einstein's pretty happy himself. He can see the potential trajectory of the evening. She wants to know how he came up with trains, clocks, bullets. He tells, and at the time, Heifetz, exasperated, shouted, "Can't you count?" at an informal chamber music get-together. He laughs and fiddles with his hair, wondering if he should explain who Heifetz is. But she whispers dreamily, "I cherish his recordings with Piatigorsky." He looks deeply into her dark eyes, imagining how he'll take off her glasses. That thought takes him somewhere else, and it takes a moment to figure out where he is. Then he turns and raises his glass to hers. They both conspire, so their fingers touch briefly as the glasses meet. Einstein's wife barges in and sees them cooing at the bar. She can do the math, and it looks more like biology than physics. Einstein turns, sees his wife, who's bearing down on them like a speeding train, shouting, "I'll unify your field, you no good lousy." His eyes get that deer in the headlights look. He half recovers and says the punchline, "I can explain everything."
This is The Poet and the Poem, and he has explained everything. That's Sunil Freeman. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we will be right back.
Thank you.
This is The Poet and the Poem. We're back again, and our guest now is Maria Van Buren. She is a poet, she's a novelist, and she's a professional book indexer, and we will find out what that means. Here she is with an opening poem.
FM Romance. I'm gonna call the radio and dedicate a song to you, a real old-fashioned melody with lines like those you fed to me. I'm gonna turn up the volume, spray on some perfume, and then I'll teach my dog to sing along, and we'll harmonize on your song. I'll mumble through the mushy parts about two timing and broken hearts. But when the song gets to the sweet refrain about finding true love again, he'll howl, and I'll give it my best, putting my poor chords to a test. My friend, I'll find the best frequency for giving up my misery.
Maria Van Buren, I'm Grace Cavalieri, and the best revenge is the pen, right?
Yeah.
Where did that get published?
That was the first poem I ever had published, and it was published in the city paper in Baltimore on August 30th, 1985. And I have to tell you, that poem is the result of a bet I made in a bar that anyone could write a country music song. And I sat down and I wrote that on the cocktail napkin, just the way you heard it.
But if you play it backwards like a country music record, does it all turn out good in the end? He gets his job back and he gets the girl back. If you read it from the bottom up.
The train unruns over Mama.
That is one facet of Maria Van Buren, who is many threads in a fabric. And we'll hear another one right now. Here she is.
I wrote this for my great niece. Do not be afraid of the crows on your cradle or their bright black corbid eyes. There might have been ravens, it's true, but in the nursery, two crows are joy. There might have been an owl, but Athena's been busy elsewhere, so do not sorrow for the loss of her sorority. And you sprang from under your mother's ribs, not from your father's. The moon would make ebony of your crows. The stars would make them starling. The sun would have them soak in her years, but the rain, my darling, will keep them close. The lullaby of their satiny murmurs, the rhythm of their soft grooming, the promise of their flight forsaken, the memories, the thought of the crows, will soothe you long past any twilight that could engender you.
What do the crows mean to you as the poet?
As an obsessive from an early age, I loved counting rhymes. And one is for sorrow, two is for joy. The crows, the counting crows. And also I love animals so much, and crows are so brilliant. The corbid brain is amazing.
You can't catch one. Have you ever tried to? My husband told me you just can't shoot a crow.
Oh,
they're
no.
They're just much too smart.
Well, I've seen people shoot them, but they are brilliant. Yeah. Ravens and crows are really brilliant birds.
If you will know Maria, you will learn so many things about octopus and bears. She lives among them. And one thing which fascinates me about her, in addition to her large, humane being, is that she's a book indexer. And I thought that at the publishing houses, they had somebody in the back room that indexed books. And I learned, no, that is not right. Tell me about the book indexing world.
Well, the publishers like to leave the index until the very last minute. So we're a harried group of people. And if we're antisocial and lonely and very badly groomed, because we don't sleep or eat at the end of the book production process, we just read and make index entries. And so our lives are lived in semi-darkness while we mutter and curse and throw mental plates in the air.
How many do you do a week or a month?
Well, I would say two books a month, because I do longer books. I'm a medical and scientific indexer, and so the books are longer.
And in 20 years, how much can you compute that fast? It could be like 2,000 then.
Yes.
Books. You've read 2,000 books, and you read every word of them.
Oh, yes. I don't read the reference list unless I have to figure out what the author thinks they're talking about. But yes, I do.
You read the book. And so indexing then is sometimes you note concepts as well as topics. So how does the brain calibrate kind of theoretically, to put it in the back of the book? How do you do that?
Well, you have to be aware of the concepts that a reader would look for. You're the advocate for both the book and the reader or user of the document. So you want to present access to that document as easily accessible access. That's very repetitive, but you want the reader to be able to find what they're looking for.
You really care about making it lucid, right? But some indexers are better than others, Maria.
Well, that's true, but I can only speak for myself. I know that I fall in love with every book that I read. I have to. I have to become obsessed and passionate about that particular book. And then, because there's a four-letter word for what I am intellectually, the next week I don't even remember the book that I indexed last week. I'm on to the next one.
She loves the book she's with.
Yes,
here
I
is
do.
Maria Van Buren. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and she's going to give you a poem.
This is a poem I wrote on the interstate, because I forgot to put any CDs in my CD player, so I was trying to think of something to sing to myself. I've got a bad monkey at home. He'll spit in your eye and beat on his brother. I don't think he had a very good mother. I know what you'll say. He's got to go, and he will, when I find a good way. I've got a sad monkey at home. He'll make you cry when he sings the blues. Then he goes and tells bad jokes about Jews. I know what you'll say. He's got to go, and he will, when I find a kind way. I've got a mean monkey at home. He calls the SPCA, but on my phone, to lie and complain that he's all alone. I know what you'll say. He's got to go, and he will, when I find a nice way. I've got the wrong monkey at home. He hates my cats and sits in my chair, and when I'm asleep, he chews on my hair. I know what you'll say. He's got to go. And he will, when I find the right way.
Where is a musician when we need one? That is terrific. I was going to ask what sets you off to write a poem, because you have such a varied panoply of subjects and tones and topics. So what happens to you to set you off?
I fall in love with a word. I will fall in love with a word, and then I just love my brain. It's my best friend. I put that word in the back of my brain, and I forget all about it in the front of my brain, and it just works. And then one day I'll be sitting down, and the back of my brain will say, write this down, honey, or you are not going to see it again. So I write it down really fast.
But you are, of many of the women I know, the most brilliant intellect that I know. How do you turn that off to let the heart do its work then? Because they really can't coexist exactly at the same moment, can they? I mean, your brain is so active that, is there a way of backing off from that when you want to be completely?
I don't know. I think they're dimensions of each other. It's like the space-time dimension. You can't tease them apart, brain and heart. They're together for life. I wouldn't want to turn one or the other off. I think they need each other, and they work together so beautifully. Why would you want one to stop working while the other is working?
Well, the database gets so busy. Here she is with her own database, Maria Van Buren.
October. In Indian summer, you can open your windows at night and watch, if you're me, your lace curtains elope into the dark. First they pick a good draft, one that glides languid across the sill. Then, on the threshold of freedom, they slither casually like thieves eluding the light. But they can't escape. They get no further than they snarl in the bushes, their hemlines ravaged by thorns. They struggle and stutter on dawn's first breath and turn her early shades into amethyst bruises in their tethered folds.
Amethyst bruises. And another.
Southwest. There might have been sky in your laughter, starlight in your doubts, canyons in your voice, a riverbed carved by your anger, flush with water the color of bone. There were petroglyphs at your core, signs that sojourners used to tell where they'd been, where they had gone, and who dwelt there. Ancient, adamantine, etched on rock the color of blood, fixed for a mineral lifetime, and yet as sun-warmed as this habit of breathing, an affair of air and artery, with a stalwart heart pushing against what would not be moved.
What was the title of that one?
Southwest.
Okay, give me one more, and I'll tell you who you are.
The Dog Fox. I've seen him twice now. He came at night, once from the south, once from the west, and traveled down my fence to the open space beyond. In the stray light, his coat gleamed the color of sunset. When I was a child, I dreaded dusk, the dinner hour, when family gathered and all the business of day's ending convened at table, where busy knives divided flesh and snapped words covered the sound of small bones breaking. Now, dusk is an appetizer for the simple gift of night, an open field where I glimpse something wild that comes to hunt or play just beyond my boundaries.
And what have you seen recently that just came to hunt and play in New Hampshire?
A bear! I just was so happy. It was a long day, and I sat down at my desk, and it was dusk, and I looked up, and there was the most beautiful blue-black being crossing my lawn. And I don't know where he was headed, but I was so grateful that he came my way.
And she said the same thing about the moose last year. So she's quite, I don't know, faithless. But here's where she lives when she does that. Toad Hall, New Hampshire. What is Toad Hall?
Toad Hall is a writers and artists retreat that I started 3 years ago. And I invite writers and artists to come up and spend time working, and the price they pay is they have to be witty at dinner, and they have to laugh at my jokes.
And I asked for a bio, and she gives me one. She is the luckiest woman on earth. Well, that sums it up. I mean, who needs anything else, right? But we have to explain that part-time you're in the lower middle of the country, and then a lot of the time you're in New Hampshire, and you are a chatelaine. What is that?
Well, the keeper of the keys.
Of the mansion?
Yes.
And how does that work? I mean, people come and stay the whole summer, people come and stay a day. How do you keep the flow of that writer's retreat going on?
Well, it's by invitation, and of course I have friends who recommend people, and I'm very lucky in that because everyone who's been recommended to me to be invited has become a lifetime friend, and people are invited to come for a minimum of a week. I don't think you can have a really good conversation. We have had people come for a dinner, and I always want more of them, and I feel like they shouldn't go home, but they insist that they have to go feed the cat or something silly. And so we like people to come for a minimum of a week. We recommend 2 weeks. And some people have stayed for a month. And it's just a gathering of minds in the wilderness. And we have a great time.
Maria Van Buren is going to read you a poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress.
Well, this is a prose poem. And it's part of my novel. And I describe my novel as a failure of poetry because I think poetry distills ideas. And then I got this idea that was too big and I couldn't shrink it down into a poem. So it's becoming a novel. But this is a small part of my novel, which is, I think, a prose poem. My mother told me I drive too fast. She's ridden in my car once or twice in 30 years. No, I must be accurate. What she actually said was, my driving endangers everyone else. This is the perfect encapsulation of what I am to her, the invisible menace. If you doubt this, consider that when I recounted to her my driving instructor's reassurance that it's very hard for family members to teach each other to drive, she immediately contradicted him. That's ridiculous! I taught all my children to drive with no problem. Don't look now, I'm invisible. 2 years ago, I drove to Baltimore looking for Paula, but that's another story. And as I started up after a red light turned green, I hit one of the city's infamous potholes. I don't think I'd been going more than 10 miles per hour, so I couldn't have done any damage. But alas, I drove home with a noise every time I turned right. I returned with an ultra-politically correct Volvo S80. When my mechanic told me the source of the noise, which I likened to a constipated bull elephant, I could have cried and kissed him. He said, "You broke your sway bar strut." Oh, the sound of that girl, my car, and I were the voodoo queens of Howard Street. It turns out we had not one but two sway bar struts, and if you doubt that, you could just listen to the moan we made when one got broken. Now my car has a name fit for some kind of queen. She's the Swedish warbird, so christened by my Star Trek-loving nephew, who loves to ride in my car. Auntie M, you could be a race car driver. But I haven't really got a name of my own due to some confusion on my birth certificate. And I want a name, one that goes with my menacing black magic persona. Or at least one that actually conveys who I could be if I let people see who I really am. Something like Sojourner Truth.
Maria with a sway bar strut. Let's have another.
At the end of River Road, where mists slope off like coverlets slipping from the bed, three young willows stand and sway, with shy hope, near trembling, in anticipation of the sun, like young girls at their first dance. Most days I leave home at dawn and never turn toward them. And I might not have looked today, but for the noise, the harsh demand, the grinding, tearing, snapping, and the shouting. The middle tree was harnessed by men with ropes and cradled in her limbs a man with a chainsaw. And even as he hacked at her and her branches fell like tresses sheared from a novitiate, she swayed to the beginning of a tune, a melody for those who find life in air. When I returned at sunset, as dusky mist ascended, her sisters shivered against the bloody sky and stretched and swept to conceal, to caress, to connect across a darkening space where once another stood.
For those who find life in air. I was telling you that this week's New Yorker features poet Gary Snyder, and he says, I am a poet who has preferred not to distinguish in poetry between nature and humanity. And guess who came to mind? You do not distinguish between nature and humanity. And that is because you're a Buddhist.
Yes.
Please tell me what a Buddhist is.
Buddhist is a person, in my understanding of it, and of course I'm way at the beginning of my journey, but my understanding is that to live on this planet as lightly as possible, to acquire as little as possible, to desire as little as possible, because when you forsake acquisition and desire, everything is given to you.
Can you do it?
I try every day. But
you're not coveting this blouse I have on?
I was earlier.
But your Buddhist tendencies overcame that? I actually am quite serious about the fact that I've watched you practice your art. I have watched you literally save a spider. Tell us just how many animals you have right now.
Oh, I lost track. That's a trick question. You want to see if I can count without using my fingers? Maybe 20.
How about, yeah, is that donkey around yet?
No, the donkey is, one is actual and one is potential. I just acquired a miniature donkey named Rascal, and he's going to have a companion who's not born yet.
And four dogs and two birds and some
four
goats and it goes, and writers who are kind of an animal.
Well, they're Homo sapiens. Yeah, they're large animals.
But you are a person who will just, I saw a moose today. I saw a bear today. It's not like, oh my God, there's a bear stalking my house, right?
Oh, no.
Embrace them.
I think you have to live every day thinking, actually, Grace Cavallari taught me this, is to look for the daily miracle. Every day something wonderful is going to happen. Grace taught me that. And so I was driving up the road and I said, something wonderful is going to happen today. I know it. And that's when I saw the mama moose with the baby moose.
And she is our miracle today. Maria Van Buren, you set me right up for that line. Here we go.
This, I want to introduce this as a poem that was published in the St. John's Review. I graduated from St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, and they were kind enough to publish some of my poems in the St. John's Review, which is the literary review published by the college. This one is Penelope's Dream. the epigraph is Navigari Necesse Est. In the cold olive bed of night, the work of day lies around me, as if some portion of sunlight were netted there, that in darkness gives up a daily gathered heat. In imagination I smooth again the wrinkled surface of my skin and resurrect a form of youth. Memory will be the shuttle of desire. Each night I lie, an island in the soft gray sea of sleep, and count as waves the doing and undoing that run together in a tide. My wakefulness, a forgotten watchfire, has grown cold, and still I cannot close my conscious eye. If I could, all I dream would be a vision, the longed-for draft, a silence unjoined from solitude, and a second, more singular journey begun.
That, if the other was a country song, this is quite chamber music. What happened to your head between the times you entered St. John's College and the time you left? And perhaps you should tell people the nature of that learning that goes on there.
Well, St. John's is popularly known as the Great Book School. There's an assigned curriculum. There are very, very minor electives that you can do in your junior and senior year where you choose to read a book that's with a small group of people. But everybody who goes to St. John's reads an assigned curriculum through the 4 years. And what happened to my head, I think, was I was exposed to not only great ideas, but I was exposed to fearless thinking, that there's no idea that you should be afraid of. You should think about everything, examine everything. And that gives you such power. I think the wonderful thing about St. John's is that it arms you for the world so that you can encounter any idea and examine all its facets fearlessly.
So you are willing to say you are changed?
Oh, yes.
Because of that experience?
Yes.
Okay. And here's the poet part of her, Maria Van Buren.
This is one of my favorite poems ever. And probably you'll ask me why afterwards. But anyway, this is After Hecuba. I tell you, no female gods give birth to warriors. No, men build gods, and afterward women stumble through their rubble. Choked on smoke, slipping in blood, we crept forward from the walls to drag the bodies back. But on that field, flatter than my breast, there arose an anger before me, and she spat at me. Why? Why not leave them for the birds, Hecuba? They should fill the bellies of some beast of the air for all the good of their ships on water or their horses on earth. My sisters, did you wonder at my fury to build a funeral pyre? From the first tiny flames until the last dusty ash, I will watch the air carry upward all the fuel of my heart. Fire, scorch bones, blister eyes, wind, bear away all the shades of what I have loved. And when the firelight fails, I will still see it where it was.
Fuel of my heart. Fuel of my heart. Why do you love that poem?
Well, because I had this idea that I was not capable of writing a political poem. And years later, I happened to open up this poem and I thought, my goodness, you wrote an anti-war poem. You wrote a feminist poem. You wrote, this thing reeks of politics.
Is Hecuba Henry V? What is Hecuba to me and me to Hecuba?
Yes.
I think.
Well, Hecuba, it was in Troy. She was the queen.
Why don't you do a whole book in that genre, a classical genre, because you give it a modern stance, but you have this great classical background. In fact, I think you actually need to puzzle out a little Latin and Greek when you're there, right? Studying at St. John's?
Greek, yes. I studied Latin in high school. I think what I'd like to do is I like to retell stories from the woman's point of view. That Penelope, who waited so faithfully with her loom, you know, why wasn't she pissed off when he got back? And Hecuba, who had to drag those bodies back from the field into the safety of the walls of Troy. You know, these women should be allowed their anger.
Twice, we were saying yesterday, a gift twice given is twice blessed. so that they exist, they can be refashioned, retooled, and fueled by the heart. Maria, let's have more.
This is a very modern, different poem. It's in every line is a different voice, and I'm not talented enough to do that, so the listener will have to imagine that my voice changes with every line. The title is After the Funeral, They Said. She went peculiar. I saw him on the street with a dowdy little blonde. Her brother threatened to sue. Where is that child? The image just won't leave my head. I wanted to thump on the coffin and shout, "Get up, you lazy cow." Don't eat those, they're stale. I opened a cookbook and there were notes written everywhere, in the margins, across the illustrations, on top of the recipes. Some of the writing might have passed for poetry, but most of it was incoherent. Has anyone seen her? For the first time in a long time, the Democrats may actually forego shooting themselves in the foot. No thanks, I'm on a diet. She was here just a little while ago. Have you seen her? It's the hottest IPO, and most of Wall Street is ignoring it. We went to Bruce's concert in the park, and the man still has his chops. Did she have her dog with her? I haven't seen her since the graveside. Who sent that enormous arrangement of carnations? She hated carnations. What's she wearing? She's a very quiet child. Has anyone seen her? Where would she go?
Maria Van Buren, you are not invited to my funeral with your notebook. That is so irreverent. You have a very quick last poem, A Kiss Goodbye.
Yes, because we're at the Library of Congress, I'm going to read the poem I wrote called Reading. I have an urge for gathering something, like the lining from the eider's nest. When I have sufficient, I'll recline beneath the cumulative cloud and warm myself in what it reflects from me, and wonder if somewhere something shivers and dies, all parental hopes blighted by its loss surround. I turn this page and that, all crossing, it seems, like chilling empty ground.
That is the voice of Maria Van Buren, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this possible, and the Witter Binner Foundation for funding the series. Our associate producer is Ken Flynn. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavallari.